Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1960, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled that it was unconstitutional for facilities for interstate travelers, like bus terminals, restaurants, and restrooms, to be segregated. Things like bathrooms for whites only would be illegal. During the spring of 1961, black and white student activists from the Congress of Racial Equality launched the Freedom Rides to test the ruling. On May 4th, 1961, the first crew of 13 Freedom Riders left Washington, D.C. for New Orleans on two buses. The late Congressman John Lewis was on one of those buses. When they reached Rock Hill, South Carolina, they were met with violence. When they reached Anniston, Alabama on May 14th, they were met by even more violence. Local officials gave the KKK permission to attack the riders without consequences. The first bus was firebombed. The riders continued to face violence, bus stop after bus stop. But over the next several months, many freedom rides followed. According to Raymond Arsenal, a civil rights historian, at least 436 riders participated in more than 60 freedom rides. On November 1st, 1961, all forms of segregation and interstate bus travel were officially banned, and Jim Crow signs had to be removed. Just 4 years later, 600 marchers crossed the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, where they faced brutal attacks by state troopers. That day is known as Bloody Sunday. The footage of the violence shocked the nation and galvanized the ongoing fight against racial injustice. Those who participated in that fight are still alive today and are still sharing their stories. And we are so happy to be joined by two of them. On July 7th, 1961, when he was just 13, Hezekiah Watkins wanted to see the Freedom Riders. So he went to the Greyhound bus station in his hometown of Jackson, Mississippi. When he arrived, the Freedom Riders were not there. They were already arrested. So he and his friend played in front of the bus stop. His friend pushed him inside the bus station. As Hezekiah turned to run out, he was arrested and sent to Parchman Penitentiary, where he was put on death row. At the age of 13, he was not familiar with those words, death row. He was there for 5 long days. He went on to be arrested 109 times. He tells his story in the book, Pushing Forward. He's now a museum docent at the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum in Jackson, Mississippi, where his mugshot is permanently displayed on a wall at the museum. The question he is most asked is, "You're still alive?" Hezekiah Watkins will be part of a virtual program on Thursday, July 22nd at the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum. It'll be streamed live on the museum's Facebook page from 4 to 5 Pacific time, and you can find a link at yourcallradio.org. Hezekiah Watkins, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. Thank you so much. We're also joined by Miss Annie Pearl Avery, a civil rights activist based in Birmingham, Alabama. Annie Pearl Avery was sent to live with relatives in Pittsburgh when she was just 9 or 10 years old, where she could decide where she wanted to sit on a bus. She returned to Birmingham when she was 14, no longer used to segregation. In the 1960s, Annie Pearl Avery worked with the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee and worked directly with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., John Lewis, and many others. She was there on Bloody Sunday and was prevented from crossing the Edmund Pettus Bridge by police. Annie is director of the Ancient Africa Enslavement and Civil War Museum in Selma, Alabama. Hi, Annie Pearl Avery. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hello.
Well, it's great to have both of you. You know, we did a show a couple weeks ago about an incredible new documentary called The Road to Justice. And in the documentary, we meet both of you. But I understand that you both have never crossed paths. Is that right? Annie, is that right?
Right. Not that I know of.
So you've never crossed paths, so it's so great to have both of you on our show to talk about your story and to talk about where we are right now. And I just want to ask both of you, what a time to have you on. As we're talking, there is a major rally in Austin, Texas. Clergy and activists are there speaking out against the voter restriction bill. And Texas Democrats left Washington, D.C., to block the Republicans' party bill. They say they'll stay in D.C. all month if they have to. Hezekiah, what are your thoughts as you think about your past and look at where we are right now?
Well, it's just another form of Jim Crow trying to sneak back into the arena. And all of it is being done totally different from the way it was done in the 60s. But the agenda is the same. We're talking suppression. But right now we are talking voter suppression that mainly affect all of us. And that is Jim Crow way of like I said, getting back into the flow of things.
Annie, what would you add when you look at these voting restriction bills? At least 14 states have already passed 22 new laws. What goes through your mind when you look at where we are today?
Well, what goes through my mind is that really, when the Civil War was over and the emancipation came on, the states' rights was a way for the southern whites and stuff like that to keep control. Now, what I think about our representatives who left Texas, I think is a great thing. I really do. I think it's a great move. It's kind of different from what I was doing earlier on, but it's a great move, and it took a lot of courage for them to do this. But where we are now, we're in a situation where a lot of these people who were white supremacists and Klansmen and stuff like that have gotten elected. they became elected officials. I think Dan Duke out of Louisiana. He said he was going to take off his white sheet and put on a suit and tie and become elected. And I think that's been a trend ever since. Matter of fact, Dixocrats, who were Klansmen and white citizens councilmen, moved to the Republican Party. And today, the Republican Party have evolved into what it is today. It's a different party from what it was years ago. We can go as far back as Lincoln, but then actually the thing with Lincoln was Lincoln said that he wanted to bring the country back together, and I think President Grant was more sufficient in terms of doing things to get us our rights, and also William Compton Sherman, who was the one who came up with the idea of the 40 acres and a mule, which we, you know, some people got, but then it stopped right away once this other guy come on as president after Lincoln was murdered. Today, I'm still demonstrating. I was arrested a couple of years just before the year before the virus. I'm still getting arrested. And the thing about the demonstrations today is that we have some violence that's happening and looting that's happening on these demonstrations. Now, we have to understand that there are people who are opportunists who wait for things like this to happen. Any kind of disaster, they will start looting and breaking in. And to associate that with the civil rights people is wrong. I don't believe in overt violence and stuff like that. We were able to do all the stuff that we did in terms of getting the Voting Rights Act passed and getting the Civil Rights Bill passed without us making us firing a shot. And I think that speaks for itself. We're outgunned and we're outmanned. So anybody who come in to our demonstrations and start looting and doing violence, these people are working against us. They're not working for us.
Hezekiah, what would you add to that? In a lot of your talks, you raise the issue of how this history is not taught in school. You say that people are embarrassed and ashamed of the true history of this country, and that is directly connected to what we're dealing with today.
Yeah. I think both sides are somewhat ashamed of what happened back in the day. I know my grandmother was very much ashamed of what happened to her, and she was somewhat silent to the fact of all the things that happened to her. And I think the whites, some whites, are ashamed because they was part of it, or if they was not a part of it, they knew about it and did nothing. But I want to go back, if I may, and kind of touch on what Miss Annie Pearl stated. And I totally agree with her in terms of what is happening today with the different movements and what take place on a protest or a demonstration, that whereas others come in and try to shame the party, make the party look bad or whatever, and you look at our days when we was there out marching, that's what we did. We marched, we protested, and we demonstrated, and we had no violence. We had no looting, because we was all there for the same purpose. And I'm just wondering now, has that purpose been forgotten, or is it being left at home, just what the deal is? How true are these individuals that's out here marching as well? Like Ms. Pearl, I am still trying to get around to do my part in a lot of the demonstration that we are having here, that we had here in Jackson, Mississippi. But it's still kind of mind-blowing somewhat to figure out what is really happening today. But let me just go on to say that racism has been around for a long time, and it's going to be around much longer when I'm gone. You see, what happened, in my opinion, when you get certain individuals in office and they able to express themselves in a way that some of our past and our present elected officials are in, then those individuals who are not elected officials, who are somewhat racist, and they feel as though if an elected official can come out and make derogatory remarks about whomever, then surely they can do the same. And this is what's happening. It's just like fire ants, in my opinion. You know, once you get on them, they go under the earth, and they stay for a minute or two until things get better, and they come out again. And this is what is happening. They are coming out in mounds, and they are spreading. So what we have to do is come up with some type of chemical to rid these fire ants, more or less. And I stated earlier about the old Jim Crow laws, and that's basically putting it in a nutshell. This is what is happening today. This is what is going on. They are putting things in place that shouldn't be, and they are going along with it the same way they did back in the 60s, back in the 50s. And right now, we have no control. The only control we have, the only control we're going to have, is to get those individuals out of office. And they are trying their best to make sure that we are not able to do that at the polls. And we have to just be very, very conscious of each election, whether it's municipal, county, state, or federal, because at each level, it affects us, whether we realize it or not.
Today we're talking with two civil rights icons. Hezekiah Watkins was arrested and placed on death row when he was only 13 years old in 1961 after he went to a Greyhound bus station in Jackson, Mississippi to see the Freedom Riders. Hezekiah Watkins is author of Pushing Forward and is a museum docent at the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum in Jackson. Annie Pearl joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee when she was just 16. She's been arrested many, many times for protesting and participating in voter registration drives across the South. She was last arrested just before COVID. Annie is director of the Ancient Africa Enslavement and Civil War Museum in Selma, Alabama. If you have any questions for today's guests, comments, thoughts about where we are right now, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org, or you can tweet us at yourcallradio. Let's spend a little bit of time talking about your childhoods. Annie, let's start off with you. You were born in Birmingham, Alabama, but when you were about 9 or 10, you had an aunt in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, whose husband had passed, and she wanted someone to come stay with you. And so you went to stay with your aunt, and you stayed there until you were 14 years old?
Actually, I stayed there. I think I was 13. But anyway, what happened is I had gotten to Pittsburgh, and I didn't know that I didn't have to ride the back of the bus when I got there. I didn't know that I could go to the movies and see the premieres of the movies before they got to the black community. Like right now, the Alabama Theater right there in Birmingham, Alabama, I haven't ever been in there. And I love the movies. I still love the movies. I look at a lot of old movies now. I got Humphrey Bogart and all these other people. DVDs that I look at all the time. And everything that came to Birmingham went to the Alabama Theater first. And then came to the black theaters. And when I came back, I was back at the back of the bus. I was older, and there were some other things that I understood. And when I heard about the Freedom Riders, I decided I was going to go with them if they came to Birmingham. And I purchased my own ticket. And the night that they were at the Greyhound bus station, they were at the Trailway bus station. It used to be another bus company called the Trailway Bus Company. The Trailway Bus Company usually serviced the smaller towns, hick towns and stuff like that. And I happened to meet a young man by the name of Wilson Brown at the Greyhound bus station. I had my own ticket, and I was telling Wilson that I met him by happenings, and I told him I wanted to go. They had a police line up, and I couldn't get through the police line, but I was middling around and met Wilson. And Wilson told me, said, "You can't go." And I asked him why. He said, "Well, you don't understand the concept of nonviolence." Well, I had a knife that I was going to take with me, and he said, "You have to be nonviolent." Well, I looked for the word in the dictionary. I didn't find it. It's in the dictionary now, but the word nonviolence was not in the dictionary at the time. So I told him to explain it to me. He said, "Well, that's when somebody hits you, you can't hit them back." I said, "I don't think I want to do that." But Wilson approached me about going to a student nonviolent coordinating committee meeting in Atlanta, and I saw it as a threefold. Number one, I had never been to Atlanta before. Number two, I was going to get a chance to go free. Number three, I was going to learn more about the civil rights movement. I left my knife at home, and everything is history after that.
Wow.
Now, I think that they are, I'm executive director at the Ancient African Slavery and Civil War Museum. And at this time, I'm trying to raise money to repair the museum. Now, there are four things that we need to concentrate on, especially black people. We need to concentrate on our vote. We need to concentrate on keeping our communities safe. We need to concentrate on our money, how we spend our money. We need to concentrate on positive things about our history before we were slaves. Now, in terms of our history, I don't think we should depend on public schools to do this. This needs to be done by black people. Also, it'd be good for whites to learn about, especially about our history before we were slaves. When we were, we created the first civilization in the world. And the more I learn, the more I find out that we, you know, it boosts our self-esteem to find out that Egypt, which was conquered by the Greeks, the name of Egypt was Kemet. And it was when it was conquered by the Greeks, they named it Egypt. Egypt is a Greek word. Now, me being there, I'm learning some things, too, because I'm coming in contact with professors of universities, professor, history professors, and I'm getting information from them, along with the information that I do my I research myself. It's very important that we control our money and also the information that go out to our children about our history. Of Birmingham, Alabama, with the boycott there. Now, we had the children who demonstrated, but what brought Birmingham down was the boycott. The same thing happened in Montgomery with the bus boycott. It wasn't the fact that Rosa Parks sat down and refused to give up her seat, but it was the fact that people stopped riding the bus, and the bus company almost went out of business. We have to understand that our money is important too. That was one of the reasons for destroying Black Wall Street. in Tulsa, Oklahoma. It wasn't just because they were of some incident that happened with a black guy falling up against a white woman or whatever. It was the fact that they were independent, which is what was important. And we need to control our demonstrations. These people are not, they're not organized as they should be, because you shouldn't have any violence going on at your demonstration.
Hmm. You know, Annie, you brought up
being infiltrated by people who want this to look like we are violent too.
Hmm.
One thing the museum contributes is the fact that we own the building. You see, a lot of whites don't come because they feel guilty. A lot of blacks don't come because they want to forget it.
Hmm.
But all in all, we need to do our own teaching, and I think that that the government, if they want to, they can give us some money. We don't get very much money from that. And other white people who support us, who truly support us, need to support that.
Annie, we're going to take a quick break. That is Annie Pearl Avery. She's executive director of the Ancient Africa Enslavement and Civil War Museum in Selma, Alabama. Annie Pearl Avery joined the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee when she was just 16 and has been arrested many, many times for participating in a number of actions. We're also joined by Hezekiah Watkins, author of Pushing Forward, Mississippi's Youngest Freedom Writer, and museum docent at the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum in Jackson. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. Well, I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are speaking with two civil rights icons, Hezekiah Watkins and Annie Pearl Avery. If you have any questions for them to talk about their past, where we are today, where we're going, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Let's hear from Michelle in Oakland. Hi, Michelle. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much. And I would also like to just thank your guests for your hard work.
I'm sorry, Michelle, can you speak up a little?
Yes, absolutely. I just want to honor and lift up the people that you have on your show today and thank them, first of all, for all their hard work for the Black community. My comments as a person from Oakland and having witnessed and heard all the violence, the police violence specifically, now the town of Oakland and Mayor Libby Schaaf is definitely addressing it, but I don't think that they're addressing it in a very quick manner, and also to reinforce the trust that's been broken after the protests occurred and the looting happened. I know to that point that the looting did not happen in conjunction with the protests, but more so as a after effect, and that those were opportunists. Mm-hmm. How can people on the ground in the Black Lives Matter movement and prevent that from happening again? Kind of more of a strategy as a person who was involved in that.
Well, thank you for that. And I'm sorry if you couldn't hear Michelle. Annie, since you brought up the violence that has been happening with some of these protests, as you said, you talked about infiltrators, and we actually saw evidence of that at some of these protesters. It has been reported. Michelle wants to know, how can people on the ground in the Black Lives Matter movement prevent this kind of opportunistic violence from happening in the future? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, for one thing, you don't just let people walk out there and say that they Black Lives Matter and represent your organization. When we were doing things, it was understood. If you went on the demonstration, you had to be nonviolent. We had marshals and stuff like that to make sure that everybody complied. If you don't believe in nonviolence, or you don't want to be nonviolent on a demonstration, and you stayed off the demonstration. We were in control of our demonstrations. you're not in control of the demonstration going on Facebook or social media saying we're going to have a demonstration. Anybody might show up. You see? And you have to have people there on duty to make sure that these things happen. So that's one of the ways that we didn't fire a shot. All the demonstrations we did, there was no violence by us.
Hezekiah, what would you add?
Well, I have to agree with Ms. Pearl. There was no violence that took place during our demonstration. But when you look at the overall picture, it's almost impossible to stop one from doing what he or she does in terms of trying to discredit your protest. Yes, we had individuals out front in the rear, but if you recall when Dr. King led that famous march in Memphis, there were protesters behind the marchers who was breaking window panes and breaking in buildings and businesses, as the marchers up front knew nothing about what was happening in the rear. And you look at the demonstration we've had in the past month, past years, that a lot of that happened not as they was marching along. Most of it happened after the marchers had marched past these individuals, and a lot of them went back at night and broke in buildings. A lot of them went back at night and set those buildings on fire. And personally, I just don't see how you can just stop. You know, if you out for a cause, you out protesting, you out marching, you really don't have time to look at other individuals. You know, you are focused on what you're doing, and your focus is also on that police officer not knowing what he or she going to do. I just don't see how you can just stop those guys and girls from messing up your march. Virtually impossible.
Well, we can't stop people from doing what, but we certainly can denounce them and let people know that these are not people are not part of our group, and let the people who are doing these things know that they are not part of our group.
Well, yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with you. But, you know, if you're out there for the cause, then, well, you don't have to be out there for the cause. General population know that those individuals are not part of you. The media know that they are not part of you. Even they know they are not part of you. I just don't have an answer to tell you what could be done to stop it.
What else would both of you add about effective activism at a time when young people are really bringing so many movements together, whether it's the fight for racial and economic justice, the climate crisis, you know, taking on the overt racist that we're now seeing in this country, what we saw on January 6th. What would you say, based on all of the incredible work that you've done and you continue to do, is most effective? What would you say, Hezekiah?
What was most effective during my tenure? Is that the question?
Yes.
Oh, wow. I would say marching and protesting was the most effective way that we got our point across. Then you mentioned January the 6th. Number one, that would have never happened. We never would have gotten on the ground if one so chose to do that. Once again, like I stated from the offset, when you get certain individuals in power, others think that they can do and say the same thing and get away with it. Not so. But to answer your question, our most effective thing was the protests and marches that we was doing back then. And everybody, number one, let me just say this, if I may. The thing we are missing today, in my opinion, is leadership. We had leaders. We had individuals who was just down with everything that was going on. No one was pulling to the left nor the right. Everybody was on the same page. And I don't think we are on this page now. A lot of us on page two, some of us on page three, and it goes on. But until we can come together and get on the same page ourselves, then we can see some difference. Hmm. But right now, there's none, in my opinion.
Annie, what are your thoughts? What would you add?
Well, for one thing, our unity, I keep saying that there are four things: our money, our unity, our vote, and positive things about ourselves will help boost our self-esteem. And it starts with teaching. Now, the thing about being able, we're not able to control everybody, but there should be a universal, especially here, we should have some unity on violence and our money. Our money is very important because a lot of places were brought down by not just because we weren't allowed to even vote in Birmingham, but I'm saying the boycott. Us not spending downtown was deserted. Deserted. And that's what brought the business people together to decide that they wanted to do something different. Now, it's up to us to come together. And also to, we still have to denounce these people who are doing these things. We have to let people know that these are not our folk and continue to say that because you're outgunned and you're outmanned. Having a gun is not going to solve our problems. Looting, but there are people who do this as opportunists. No matter what happens, any kind of disaster, snow disaster, a storm disaster, there are groups of people who wait on things like this to happen and start doing things. And we have to continue to denounce these people. And we need to get control of our organizations and our demonstrations. If we have to come together with different organizations, there's so many organizations, and a lot of these organizations are not addressing all of the problems that they're addressing their end, whatever they consider their opinion is. But there are four main things that I found that needs to be addressed and handled. And it needs to be done by black people. We have to do, although we know that we are entitled to reparations and all this other stuff, we can't wait on that. It's our responsibility, and it's responsibility of whites who believe in justice and believe in the right thing to do is to support us. And I'm Just like I say, I'm at the Ancient African Slavery and Civil War Museum. I still go do demonstrations. But my main objective is to educate blacks and whites about who we, what's happening and what will happen. I have some friends in SNCC who are white, and I was saying to one of my friends, I was telling her about a stereotyping situation, and she said, "Well, why, Annie Pearl, why did you say that?" And I said to her, I said, "Daddy, you're not black. It's not happening to you. You go into a store, they're not following you around. They're not looking at you." It's happening to me. So then she began to understand. But she, I said, "You're back in New York or wherever, and these things are not happening. The only time it would have happened to you is you were in the South associated with me as a black person. And during that time, during the day, the 60s and stuff, if you were seen black and white, you were considered part of the civil rights movement. But otherwise, you go wherever you go, and nobody think anything about stereotyping you. But I get stereotyped everywhere I go. And we're going to have to take responsibility. We can fight and pray and do all this other stuff, but it's not going to change the situation until we start taking responsibility. As a matter of fact, I even emphasize that the Chinese were enslaved at the same time we were.
That is Annie Pearl Avery, a civil rights activist who is part of the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee in the 60s and director of Ancient Africa Enslavement and Civil War Museum in Selma, Alabama. We're also joined today by Hezekiah Watkins, author of Pushing Forward, Mississippi's Youngest Freedom Rider, and a museum docent at the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum in Jackson, Mississippi. Hezekiah, we have a question from a listener who says, "Can you talk about the need for a wider working class coalition like Fred Hampton with the Black Panthers, who constantly talked about that, bringing together a wide class of people. What are your thoughts?"
And I agree. We must work on that, bringing all individuals together to have a working body to move not just us, but this country forward. We cannot do it by ourselves. We need everybody, on hand, every person on board to do just this. And yes, ma'am, we do. And we must.
Hezekiah, if we can spend a little, we're almost out of time, but if we can talk a little bit about your story, and I wonder how it has shaped the way you look at the prison system today. And I mean, the fastest growing segment of the prison population right now are women, mostly women of color. And for listeners who maybe missed the beginning of the show, just to give a little bit of background, when the Freedom Riders were coming to Jackson, Mississippi, I understand that your family and your pastor said you really shouldn't get involved in this because something bad could happen. There could be killing, they could burn the house down. But you really wanted to see the Freedom Riders because, as you've said in your past talks, you thought that they had to be Superman and Superwoman. And so when you went to the Greyhound bus station, they had already been arrested. But you actually got arrested at age 13. Can you just briefly tell us about that story?
Yes. Like you stated, I was very, very fascinated with what I saw in Alabama on the TV. And they became my heroes and sheroes. And my friend informed me one day that, "Hey, those Freedom Riders are going to be in Jackson." And we just had to go and look at them. I wanted to see what a freedom rider looked like in person, what a freedom rider dressed like, walked like, talked like, the whole nine yards. And I just thought maybe, just maybe, I might have the opportunity to reach out and touch one. But we get to the bus station, and they had already been arrested and taken away. So my friend and I, we decided to just have a little fun downtown Jackson to do some things that we could not do during the day. And that was play on the sidewalk, play downtown Jackson, even drink out of the water fountain. They had two fountains, one red colored, the other red white. And we had been led to believe that the white water fountain was better. The white water fountain was cooler. The white water fountain was something like Kool-Aid. And during this time, we was some Kool-Aid kids. We loved Kool-Aid, and we drank from the white water fountain and just enjoyed ourselves. And we walked back to the Greyhound bus station, and as a joke, my friend pushed me inside of the station. After being pushed inside, I was detained by an officer. And the officer asked, "Why are you in here?" And I politely said, "My friend pushed me in here. He's out there." He said, "Out where?" "He's on the outside." He caught me by my wrist with a firm grip, led me on the outside and said, "Where?" When on the outside, my friend was nowhere to be found. I was taken back inside, and he yelled, "I have another one over here," not knowing what that meant. But he was telling the other officers, "He have another freedom rider." So when the officers came over, they handcuffed me and sat me down and asked me two questions, your name and your birthplace. Well, just so happened, I was born in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, that whereas my father, my two older brothers, along with my mother, left Mississippi for a better life during the migration period. So they moved to Milwaukee. A few months later, I'm assuming, not sure how long, but I came along. And a few years later, my father died, and my mother had to make her decision, do I stay here in Wisconsin, or do I move back to Mississippi? And that's what she did. Now, I was always told to tell the truth. So when the officer asked me, "Where were you born?" I was born in Milwaukee. But I was not a freedom rider at the time. And I was taken from the bus station to the state prison. And from the state prison, I was put in a place they call death row. And being somewhat country, very naive, I did not know the meaning of death row. I was in a cell with two other inmates who was there for murder. And they educated me on death row. They educated me on how I was going to die. They educated me on basically everything because I was green. They taught me how to smoke a cigarette. All of these things happened to me in Parkman. But we had a president named John F. Kennedy who, I'm told, called our governor, who was Ross Barnett, and told Ross Barnett he did not want to see another Alabama in Mississippi. So whatever needs to be done, you have all of the resources that we can provide for you. But make sure the Freedom Riders are safe. And upon that call, I was released. Thank God, because I really feel as though I wouldn't be here today if I had stayed in Parchman Prison. brought me back to Jackson, and my mother beat the hell out of me for disobeying her and going to the bus station. But thereafter, I teamed up with a gentleman by the name of James Bevel, who became my mentor and still is today, although he's deceased. But everything that he taught me, I still remember.
And that was five long days in that prison at just 13 years old, which most people cannot even begin to imagine. Hezekiah, I'm sorry, we're almost out of time. I'm sorry to interrupt you. Would you leave our listeners with a last note? People who are, you know, working really hard to change things so much in this country, given your past, what you're still doing today, what would you say to people?
I will tell them they can make a difference in their lives. You know, we look at those that made a difference are no longer with us. And I tell individuals, those people came from a total different mode, a total different era than what we came from. But we still have that same ability to go out and lead. We can go out and lead, maybe not like Dr. King, maybe not like John Lewis and the others, but we can do something positive within our community, within our church. There's always something there that's positive that needs to be done. There's a problem where I live in my city, Jackson, Mississippi. We have a problem with the homeless. Go out and feed the homeless. Go out and do something. This is my story that I preach to individuals on a daily basis. Just don't sit there like a log. Be active in a positive way.
Well, thank you. Thank you so much for your sharing your stories. I wish we had another hour so we can continue speaking with you and learning from you. Hezekiah Watkins is author of Pushing Forward, Mississippi's Youngest Freedom Writer, and a museum docent at the Mississippi Civil Rights Museum in Jackson. Miss Annie Pearl Avery is executive director of the Ancient Africa Enslavement and Civil War Museum in Selma, Alabama. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thanks
to Leah Cesarine for producing today's show. I'm really sorry, Miss Pearl. We're out of time. I'm already past my time, but thank you so much for joining us. Thank you. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.